and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight, Peter, I'd like to call him Peter Max, Peter R., is coming back to visit. He's been a regular at NABBA, but his home is over at 8111 at one of the home groups there. On Thanksgiving, he puts out the best spread around here at NABBA. He's done so for several years, and I think he's going to be back for more. So he's going to give you a little taste of what he's all about.
Hey, I'm Peter. I'm an alcoholic. I need to step stool. I'm short. All right. Well, I'm going to say how it was, what happened, and what it's like now. So, it's a lot of people in here. All right. So my story is like a lot of people here. I just want to kind of say a disclaimer because I know this is an AA meeting, but there's a lot of drugs in my story, and to not talk about my drug addiction I seriously feel would be a great disservice to my story. So I'm going to keep it in, and also, you know, I went through a lot of therapy and had a lot of abuses to me, kind of like outside issues, but it's part of my story as well, so it's, you know, I'm going to keep all that stuff in here. I moved 21 times before I graduated from high school. I had three moms and three dads. Mom's working on number four right now, so that story continues and progresses. So I've had a lot of step-siblings throughout my life. And just basically read into that there was no stability in there. I was raised by my mom and grew up with my sister, and like I said, a lot of different, a lot of stepbrothers, and my second dad was very physically abusive to us. I don't know, that sounds so light. He used to beat the ever-living shit out of us, so that's how that went down. So he wasn't around too long. You know, talking about the early years, when I was 7 was the first time I got drunk. My mom was having a party with coworkers, and, you know, people were giving sips to the little kid there, and I was that little kid, and everybody was giving me sips. So next thing you know, the 7-year-old is wasted puking. And, you know, by the time I was 13, I was... you know, I was sexually active at 13. I was going to parties. I was very, you know, social. Because of all the moving, I made a deal with my folks that I wanted to stay my junior year in the same school. So my senior year of high school, I had my own apartment in Charleston, South Carolina. So this is a safe, you know, wholesome environment for a 17, 18-year-old to be in. So I had not done drugs at this point. I was just drinking and still making it through school. I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old, and was very fit in high school athlete, and someone had showed me a video at a Navy recruiter when I was younger, and it was of Navy SEAL training, so I'd wanted to be a SEAL. That rogue warrior, tough guy lifestyle really appealed to me. And I felt like I had no conscience. I could just blank that out. You know, I'd moved so much and I had dealt with so much. I was always the new kid. I could just kind of shut it down. And I was like, I'm tough and I can just shut it down so I can do this. So, I got into the Navy and I got into SEAL training. And it's hard, and I blew my knee out. I don't have any cartilage left in my knee, so at 19, I was discharged from the Navy and a disabled veteran, and I had these blinders on for what life was going to be like for me, and it didn't work out that way. So I really had no idea what to do. I was, you know, I mean, I was just totally lost. And while I was getting discharged from the Navy, they figure you can't handle yourself in SEAL training doing drugs and stuff like that, so they don't PP test, or back when I was doing it, they don't P test you in that arena. So I started smoking pot and taking LSD, and basically when people would come by and say, Peter, do you want a yes, would, you know, I would say yes before they even finished the sentence. It was just like, you know, life sucks and this is blanking me out, so let's keep doing it. So by the time I was discharged, I was a regular pot smoker. I never turned away anything in front of me. I got an honorable discharge, honorable medical. I got out of the military. I started doing electrical work. Met some guys. They introduced me to this little white powder, cocaine, and that was cool. And, you know, I didn't really have access to it, so I didn't really do it that much. I was smoking pot a lot, drinking, doing any drugs I could get my hands on. I was really outdoorsy, doing rock climbing, camping and stuff like that, mountain biking. So I never let the partying get too much where I couldn't do these, like, fun, cool activities. But this is, you know, just kind of like that core, that baseline of introducing that into my life. I met this girl while I was doing all of these things, and we immediately moved in together because I've made great choices at that time in my life. And I started going to college, and I went to Georgia State for a year, moved down to Tampa, Florida, and went to USF, University of South Florida, for a year. And then this dude who I was in training with gave me a call. I was keeping in touch with him, and he had just bought a bar in Manhattan. And he said, Peter, I need someone I can trust to help me run it. So I was like, yeah, let's do this. So I moved up to New York City. I broke up with this girl because New York City's cooler. And started running a bar in New York City. So, I mean, obviously the drinking really progressed at this point. I didn't know how to bartend, so I would shut the place down at night and open up the Mr. Boston's book and just start going through. And, you know, you make a drink, drink a drink, make a drink, drink a drink. And I would, you know, get through a few pages and all was well. I taught myself how to bartend, and I became quite good. So I worked with this guy for a couple of years, and that relationship deteriorated, as many did in my life. I had a group of friends whose dads were all these, like, cool gangster-style guys. They had huge apartments in the city, and the wives were very subservient. And it was bizarre. I'd never kind of met any people like this. They were all of a specific nationality. They weren't Italian, so. But, and I kind of got in with this group, and I had impressed these people. I had this, you know, tough military background. I was very good at the, running the bars and the restaurants and stuff like that. So, they got me into opening up this new restaurant in New York City. And, I mean, you know, it was an organized crime group of people. So next thing I know, I'm laundering money, embezzling, dealing with bookies. And I was a part of something finally. And it was really cool for me. I fit in with these people. They looked up to me because it was like, you know, they're of a, I'm Jewish by heritage, and it's like, oh, get the Jew who's good with the numbers and put him in the basement. And I mean, I was doing a good job for them. So, I was making a lot of money as in this lifestyle, legally and illegally, and my ego was getting exponentially larger each day. So, I was buying everything in sight. This is, you know, I grew up very poor, trailer parks, shit like that, and, you know, one of the stepdads was Christian, and we celebrated Christmas. And, you know, there were a couple of years we didn't have Christmas because it was like, we don't have any money, so let's just not bother with the tree and not do anything. And, you know, I was a kid. I was like, sure, that sounds great. You know, as a father now, I see the kind of the fallacy in what was going on in my life. So I had all this money, and I was in New York City with all the money I could spend, and the drugs started to really creep in more. That cocaine just fed on that ego, and it was just getting ramped up more and more. I was drinking all the time and doing drugs all the time. And I was that functioning, whatever that is, the functioning alcoholic addict. That was me. Then 9/11 happened while I was living in New York City, and that little veneer of this safe world that I had was just ripped from me. I lost a number of friends that day, some very close friends. The girl I was, it was my girlfriend. She was literally right around the corner there at a job interview, and it freaked me out. It freaked me out living there. It freaked me out after it. I don't want to go into all of the details of what it was like living there, but it was very difficult and traumatic for me. And the next few months were filled with just going to memorials and services and masses, wakes, everything. I mean, just, you know, every Sunday, every Saturday, all the time, just going and, you know, trying to honor the people who had passed. And I was taking painkillers, too, on a regular basis. So, basically, drinking heavily, using cocaine weekly, taking painkillers almost daily. Then the cocaine really started to ramp up and took over. That was the go-to. I started to really not become present in my life. It was a point where I was using that drug, you know, 5 to 7 times a week, and I did 7 to 9 8-balls a week, just really going for it. And this was the perfect time for me to get engaged. So I got engaged at that time. I had this very clear memory of the night before the engagement. I did not use drugs that evening. And I still feel that pain and that itch, that crush in my chest, that yearning that I needed. And it was awful. I don't know how I did it. I really don't, but I didn't. And the next day, so I could actually, you know, wake up and have a day where I could, you know, ask someone to marry me. Anyway, at that point, I just couldn't stop. I was getting up in the morning or the afternoon, whenever it was. I have to stop doing this. I have to stop using. And I couldn't, you know, this is the day I'm not going to use today. And by the time I was walking to work, I was calling my dealer up just every single day. I would miss some days. So it's like I say 5 to 7 days a week. It was every day that I was on it. I couldn't figure out what to do. I knew I couldn't stop. I have my stepmom, who I love and respect very much. She's still in my life. I called her up, and she had told me stories of the fact that she's got a lot of people that used to, you know, really party real hard for where she worked. And I was like, I can't stop using drugs. What do I do? And she was like, Peter, I don't know what you should do. I will ask around. I mean, I'd never heard of AA. One of the guys who owned a bar down the street from the one I ran, he went to rehab. I mean, literally, this was all of in my, you know, arsenal of knowledge of recovery was the one dude who disappeared and my stepmom saying, I don't know. So I was wasted one evening, really trying to get a handle on things, and went on the internet and started typing recovery and rehab, and I think rehab was the Google search. Well, a place called Narcanon popped up first, and it looks like a really, really pretty place. It's on the, you know, on the water, and you know where it is then if you're smiling. No? Okay. And it looked like a really, like a Frank Lloyd Wright building, and it looked like a spa, so I was like, perfect. Well, I get there, and, you know, just like everywhere else, it's I'm in New York City. It's in Omaha, Oklahoma City. So I get to this place, and, you know, the first, like, 3 days are in the detox, because every treatment center you go to detox. Well, I come out of the detox, and I'm walking around, and there's these big posters of L. Ron Hubbard everywhere, and yes, it's a Scientology rehab I had checked myself into while I was wasted. So I realized the error of my ways and split, and, you know, had to talk my way out of that. I don't want to spend too much time, but it's funny. Yeah. So I, you know, fear was going to keep me sober. I'm like, okay, I can do this at home. I went to an outpatient program, continued to drink and use. I even told my fiancé, well, keep pee tests at home. I'll go buy them, and whenever you want to, well, pee test me, and I'll come clean. And I failed every single one of them. So I, you know, skipping along the bottom, I checked into another big fancy treatment center up in Westchester where the CEOs went. It's had it had like five people in, like, in the treatment center, and a little par 3 golf course. I didn't play golf. I wasn't a CEO, but I felt myself as a golfer CEO type. So, you know, I was, the only time I was clean was during lockdown, you know, in an inpatient treatment center. 3 days after I got out of the place, was called the Retreat, I get out. I've already got the plan. I go get teeth pulled to get pills. I just, you know, well, you know, I had my little secret in the bottle that everybody saw, and you can count these pills. Well, they didn't see, you know, this bottle over here that I was hiding. You know, it's just the same shit we all pull. I was going to a shrink as well because I wanted to do my, you know, my treatment center sort of stuff. You know, I was going to fix me, and I was going to do it my way. So the psychiatrist told me to stop coming because every time I showed up, I was high, because that's how I could communicate. It got to the point where I just, everything was getting in the way of my drinking and using. I had to fix my life, so I went to culinary school, and I figured another job would be the right thing. So think about this. You know, I'm the general manager of bars and restaurants, and I think being a chef is the right place for me. That's the right next, you know, clean my act up sort of job. I mean, what a lot of dope fiend drug addicts the kitchen guys are. I mean, we are just as bad as the front. I go to culinary school, I work in kitchens, and I am just, you know, I'm just continuing on. Nothing has stopped. So I split up with my fiance because she was getting in the way of the drinking and using. New York City was now my problem, so I moved from New York to Atlanta because, you know, an entire city is my problem. It can't be me. I was stealing pills from everyone around me. I would go to my grandmother's place. She's in a great deal of pain, and I would bring my grandmother flowers as a facade in order to go be with her to steal her pills. I mean, what a friggin' dirtbag. I mean, seriously, this is a good woman. This is, you know, one of the stable people in my lives. One of the good people, one of the people I look up to. Some of the only people in my family. I'm like, that is a stable, hardworking person who has made it through this world in the good and the bad, and I'm there stealing her pills. You know, I managed to get a job at a restaurant here. I was helping opening up a really fancy place. I did a no-call, no-show on opening night. If you've ever been in the restaurant industry, that's not really a good time to be to pull the no call, no show. So, you know, here I checked myself into to Sierra Tucson after this. Let me back up a little bit. This, I want to talk about my bottom here. So I do the no call, no show. It is September 11th, and I think the restaurant was opening on the 12th or something like that, and it's 2005. And I am in my own personal hell. I am so uncomfortable in my skin. I was doing such a crappy job at work. I mean, I'm not the most amazing chef in the world. I'm good at what I do. I was putting out shit, absolute shit. I was not showing up on time. How could I? So I do the no call, no show, and then I lock myself in my condo. I was living alone at the time, and I proceeded to drink and use for 6 days straight. I took a bottle of pills, and I took them all at once and washed them down with some alcohol, obviously. And I was trying to kill myself. I was trying to end it. I wanted it to be a soft ending, you know, that sort of like, oh, I'm so high, kind of death. So I ended up just puking everywhere and passing out for a day and a half. I woke up pissed that I was alive. And, I mean, I have a gun, and in my room for the next few days, I'm trying to figure out the right way to kill myself, to not make the big mess, to just end it all, and I never could do it. So I'm going through my liquor cabinet, just drinking. My place is a mess. I haven't brushed my teeth. I haven't showered. I haven't cleaned anything. I mean, it was disgusting. I lived in a complete horror for those days, just trying to blot it out. I couldn't drink enough or smoke enough to kill myself. I couldn't pull the trigger. I was just beaten, completely beaten. So my dad and stepmom were on vacation. They didn't hear from me. They just had that vibe, something's wrong. So they had the door people at the building knock on my door. I opened up the door, and they see, you know, you can imagine what someone looks like after that. So they're like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, great, I'm sick. Sorry, you know, I'll call my folks back, because I had unplugged the phone because I didn't want to hear anybody calling me. So I kind of, like, snapped out of it, and I get home. I mean, they get home, and I'm like, I need help. I need something. So I go talk to a therapist, and I tell her what I had done, and she's like, you need to go to a treatment center. I'm like, I've already been to two. What do I need to go to a third? And she goes, well, I'm just, you know, really concerned for you because you tried to kill yourself. So I'm like, okay, I'll go again. So on the West Wing, I was watching a television show, and the guy who was the president's helper dude, it had went to Sierra Tucson on the show. So I call up Sierra Tucson. I mean, I am really making good decisions here. You know, it's funny, but it's like, this is how I was thinking at the time. It's like, well, if the fake president's first, you know, the guy can go there, I can give it a shot too. So, it turned out to be, the best thing I could have done. I'm the day before I leave, I'm throwing all my stuff down the trash chute, all of, the paraphernalia, and I was keeping the alcohol, I was keeping the liquor cabinet and my fancy wine selection, because I was just going to give drugs up and, stop drinking for a little while, but I wouldn't give up my alcohol completely. But I did promise myself one thing, that I was going to be honest there. Because I had lied to everyone and everything that had been trying to help me. I'm like, just going to be honest. So I did that. I get there, And this is a place that dealt with not just addiction. They dealt with eating disorders, sexual disorders, codependency disorders. You know, different people had, you know, serious abuses growing up, you know, and the commingling of all of these things. So it was amazing for me because I got there and was doing the paperwork and I was being honest and I had literally blocked out these sexual abuses I had suffered as a child. Had no idea that I had went through these things, and it came out while I was there. So if you've been to a treatment center or you've seen about one, you know, one on TV or a movie, and you see the guy in the corner who's cuddled up in the ball, kind of rocking back and forth, just kind of staring out into space, that was me. I didn't know what to do with all of my feelings. It was all coming at me at once, and thank God I was there. I really worked through all of that stuff, and I continued to when I got out. They gave me suggestions on doing an intensive outpatient program, and here's another thing. I took these suggestions. This is where I became teachable. I was beaten down. Oh, and another thing. I know I had mentioned the alcohol thing. I realized that I needed to stop drinking, too. I needed to give it all up. That was a big revelation for me because I had separated the drugs and the alcohol. And, you know, it's like I can give up the drugs but still have a glass of wine, even though I had proven time and time again that I could not have that glass of wine and stay away from the drugs. So, all of that came together. So I came out of the treatment center, went into the intensive outpatient program. I was doing a men's group from a doctor friend of mine. So I was doing individual therapy, a men's group therapy, intensive outpatient program, and was coming to AA. So I was like, I'm going to take all of these things I have available to me, and I'm going to use them to their fullest capacity. And I did that. And I did a 90 and 90. I got a sponsor. And I chose my sponsor by this. I was in a meeting, and I decided that day I was going to get a sponsor. And the gentleman in front of me raised his hand during the, are you going to, you know, who wants to be a sponsor time. And he was the closest to me. So after the meeting, I walked up. I was like, you raised your hand? That's all I could handle. I didn't know how to communicate anymore. Everything that had come out of my mouth for my whole life was shit. I was trying to manipulate you. I was trying to get on your good side. Anything good I did for you was to make myself feel better. I didn't know how to have an honest conversation. I didn't know how to, hey, it's nice to meet you, and mean, hey, it's nice to meet you, or say, how was your day, and couldn't wait till you'd shut up so I could tell you about mine. So, that was, you know, this guy was good, you know, he was a book guy. I'm going to go through the book with you, and that's how I did. As we worked together, we went through the book page for page, you know, and went through the steps as they're laid out in the book. Let's see, during about day 60, I had my 60-day freak out. I've heard this is common to have the 60-day freak out. I was having using dreams for like a month and a half straight. And this aided in my getting close to spirituality because I started praying for them to stop. It was the first time I really prayed for something and meant it. You know, before that, the suggestions were to pray in this program. I was like, you think it's going to help? I'll give it a shot. I don't feel shit. But I started like, please relieve me of these dreams. I mean, you know, waking up sweating, feeling like I'd relapsed every day wasn't that great. So, you know, I'm driving down the road, and I stop, and it's just overwhelming, and I'm shaking my car steering wheel, screaming at the top of my lungs by myself. You know, no one had cut me off or anything. It was just I was flipping out. I didn't drink that day. And that was, you know, that was the beginning of some of my sober experiences, that I could go through things, I could feel things, I could think things, and not pick up a drink or use. I started to get in with the fellowship. as Tim was saying, I used to do the Thursday night dinners downstairs for like the first year and a half of my recovery, and I mean that's where the fellowship for me came from. Like I said, I didn't know how to communicate with people, and I didn't want to communicate with people. So the meetings, you know, I would stick around and people would talk to me and I would listen, but I couldn't really talk very well, and I didn't know what to say. I really didn't. I didn't. How was your day? What's up, man? How are you? I really didn't know what to do. So working in that kitchen, you know, really helped me out. People would come up to me. Peter, thank you so much for doing these dinners. Cool, you're welcome. And, you know, the story was like, wow, yes, you're welcome. Wow, I was doing that. You know, I met Woody down there, and if I don't know if anybody knows Woody, but, you know, it was this... He's this guy who looked like he was made out of leather. He had throat cancer. He barely could talk. You know, you barely understand him. He learned how to cook in the prison system. And, you know, me, I'm from the French Culinary Institute. And, you know, and I loved this guy. I mean, I loved this guy. Oh, he was awesome. You know, he just helped me out so much. The guy passed sober with like 31 years or something. And just a huge part of my life at that time, the beginning of my recovery, to have, you know, a friend like that, that, you know, wasn't someone who I was keeping as a friendship, as a pocket to show other people. Like, oh, well, my friend this, my friend that. This is my friend. I didn't care what other people thought or if people thought about it. This was my friend. So I started to go bowling on Saturday nights as well. I forced myself into that because I knew I needed to be more social. I knew the fellowship was part of this program, so I had to get into the fellowship. So I would go bowling, and we would bowl at the bowling place. And sometimes I would talk, sometimes I wouldn't. But it was great. You know, I started getting some people's numbers, and we would talk, and, you know, I was gaining that fellowship. So as I progressed through the steps, you know, the fourth step was a big eye-opening thing. I really found my place. I was very excited to write down, you know, before I got to the fourth step, I was very excited. I was like, oh, I get to write down all the people I'm pissed off at. And that I looked forward to this. And then as my sponsor was explaining this to me, I realized that I actually had to talk about my place in things. And that really freaked me out, that I actually had a place in it. It sounds so simple, but this was a huge aha moment for me. The fifth step, I went through. It took 3 sit-down sessions for us, just because the time frame worked with my sponsor and I. And it started off me talking like this, and at the end, I was just talking like this. I just barely could get the words out. I was almost whispering what I had done. I just, you know, felt like such shit. People are like, oh, did you feel so good after your fourth and fifth step? I felt like shit. And continued to until halfway through the ninth step. I didn't have that fun pink cloud in the beginning of my recovery. It really sucked. And I hated every minute of it. And I'm glad I did, because these are things that today, you know, remind me why I continue to do this stuff. So as I was going through my ninth step and making my amends, I made amends to my mom, and we sat down, we were having the talk, and I learned why we moved so much. And basically, you know, a lot of my childhood was explained to me. So I got this amazing blessing from having the steps in my life, actually taking the action to working the steps. It was a really incredible experience that she shared some really deep, dark, nasty, nasty stuff about, you know, why I went to 3 first grades. You know, I never really thought to ask specifically. I just knew stuff was rough and we had to move a lot. That was just it. I have a story about taking suggestions and them working out. So when I was ready to get my first job, you know, if you noticed, I had a lot of recovery stuff going on. And it was, you know, I think I was around, you know, 3 or 4 months. It was time to get a job. I wanted to start doing something light, more of like a recovery job. So my mom owns an animal shelter. I was going to go shovel some dog poop and just kind of get in the cage, do the poop, and not really have to talk to anybody. But I was, you know, I was showing up, and I was doing a good job, and that's what I was going to do. So my sponsor was like, hey, Peter, why don't you try and get something loosely associated with the culinary field? Just, you know, maybe think of something like that. So instead of doing, you know, Peter's way, I did that, and I started, I was selling whisks and spatulas at a cooking store. So, you know, big ego Peter, I had a penthouse in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, culinary degree and all this stuff, and I'm selling whisks at $8 an hour, and I really, you know, had to tamp the ego down and just answer questions that people asked me, and they didn't care about my life story or my resume. They wanted to know which whisk was better. And I would tell them. And you know, this cooking store had a cooking school associated with it. And over time, for showing up and doing a good job and, you know, not being a complete asshole, I eventually became the culinary school director at this. I started off teaching classes there. And then, you know, that progressed into this a beautiful job that I would not have gotten if I hadn't have just taken that suggestion of, hey, I'm going to go shovel dog poop as my first sober job, or why don't you try this route? And I did, and it worked out really nice. I don't have that job anymore, but it was, I think, very, very fondly of it. So as time progressed, you know, I had the steps in my life, and I was single, and I wanted to start dating. So I start the online dating, and, you know, I'd done what I needed to do. I had the steps. I felt spiritually fit. It's time to move forward. So thank God I had the steps in my life, because dating is insane. And I didn't have that drink. I didn't have that, you know, sit down and some girl sitting there huddling, you know, hovering with her purse, talking to me, you know, with coffee in the afternoon. And I'm like, I'm not jacking your bag, lady. You know, I just, you know, I have all of these crazy stories of the dating thing, and I got sick of it. You know, I went on a few dates with this one girl, and we needed to part ways. So I was able to break up with someone, and I did not have a resentment against them, and I didn't have to make an amends. It was shocking. The idea that I could break up with someone and not have to do these things. It wasn't some firestorm insanity. It was just like, this isn't working out. Let's part ways. I let go on this instance. It's like, all right, I'm going to stop managing my dating life. And once I did that, amazing thing happened. I was set up on a blind date with some friends from some friends, and I meet this girl, and we form this relationship based off of honesty and mutual respect, and I'm married. So, you know, it took its course naturally. We didn't rush things as I was used to. It, you know, basically, I feel like it worked out the way it should have worked out. And it's supposed to work out. It's not supposed to be this hot, heavy explosion, you know, after a week and a half. It was, you know, we got to know each other. And, you know, it talked about recovery and, you know, what that was in my life and what it meant. And, you know, she's not in recovery, but she understands what this is to me. And the person that she loves and is married to needs this to be who I am. And without this, I've told her the story. She doesn't want that guy. she knows, she's heard of that guy, and she's met him, you know, in her 20s, and she doesn't, you know, she doesn't want to do that. She's been down that road too. So, cool. I get to talk about kids. All right. So here's, this is where, you know, man plans, God laughs. You've heard a number of different versions of this. So, we have our first child, got a boy, and we're both in our late 30s. So we're like, you know, and we knew we wanted to have kids because we spoke about that before things happened. You know, we spoke, had conversations at the right time, not after the fact. Like, you're pregnant? Did you want to have kids? Do I want to have kids? So, you know, we have our boy, and we don't know whether we're going to have a second one. And man, we sit and we lament and we talk and we write charts on whether we're going to have a second child. You know, pros, cons, our life now, our life then, you know, financial, all of this stuff. So we decide that we're going to have a second child. And I am someone who's like, you can't shock me. You cannot shock me. I mean, I've worked for the mob. I've done enough drugs to freak you out. You know, I have seen man do awful, awful things. I've seen man do wonderful, beautiful things. You can't shock me. That was my like mantra. So we go in to the doctor's office for her first ultrasound, and oh, twins. So I was shocked. So I never say that again. You can shock me. Easily shocked here. So we have twin girls that are 19 months younger than my son. And you don't sleep during these times if you don't know. And I was not sleeping, and my sponsor had stopped coming around to meetings. And I needed a new sponsor, so I'm not sleeping, working my ass off. Literally, when I say not sleeping, I was going to work full time on one day of sleep every 3 days. I started to develop some very serious allergic reactions. I was physically ill from all the stress, and I needed a new sponsor. So we'd moved up to Sandy Springs, and It was time to, you know, I was looking around. I wanted to do more than just find the guy next to me that had raised his hand. And I was sitting kind of in the back of the room, and I hear this guy sharing. And I'm like, and he's talking, and I'm like, and I literally in my head, pardon me, I was like, is this motherfucker making fun of me? I seriously thought that. I was like, this guy's heard me share before, and he's screwing with me. And it was pissing me off. And I realized that he was not. Because then I'd seen this guy, and so I heard him share another time at another meeting, and he was kind of on that same thing. I was like, son of a bitch. So I was just blown away. I'd never heard someone, you know, tell my story. So I come to find, you know, I meet the guy. I'm like, oh, man, you just blew me out of the water. And he's like, I'm reading your mail, huh? And I get, you know, the guy's got, you know, he's now has 30 years, so he's been around for a little while, and just knew that he blew me up. And I asked him to be my sponsor. So it has been an incredible thing going through, you know, that initial sponsorship to this. You know, I found this gentleman, and, you know, not just that he told my story, he's also someone who, you know, he's got 30 years, obviously he's older than me, but his wife's never seen him drink. He's a father, his children have never seen him drink. Yeah, you know he's in the room, right? and, you know, all of these things, just, it was like, oh, this is what I need, and this is what I needed. I, you know, we have gone through some step work, and, you know, to have someone like this in my life now, with the way my life is right now, is just, it's so incredible. I have sponsees now. I go to meetings. I have the fellowship in my life. I have the kids. I'm a business owner. You know, I'm a productive member of society again, and by no means do you take financial in there at all. Talking about being a productive member of society that I am a member of, I don't detract from society like I used to. So I have these like incredible side jobs in the chef world, so I get that fix that I love because I truly love being a chef. And I mean, the promises have really come true for me in my daily life. They really have. You know, I have that system set in place that was set in place years before me of keeping my fears in check. You know, I'm able to point that finger back at me and see where is my place in that. I'm able to deal with those justifiable angers that happen in my life. I'm able to deal with the 3-year-old, which is insane. I mean, there's no logic in there. You know, you can't argue with when there's no logic involved with this, and it's frightening to me because I think of myself as a fairly logical person. So I really haven't had an issue where in my life that this program has not been able to assist me with, and. I mean, recently, my wife and I went up with an adult's trip to New York City, and I went to the 9/11 memorial, and I visited my friends' names, and I cried, and it was incredible. It was incredible. It was incredibly hard, but it was real, and I was able to do that. I never thought I could do that. I used to, you know, when people shared, you know, September 11th would come around, and people would share about their experiences. The hell, you know, you weren't there. Just all this crap. It was crap. And now I can accept this in my life. And just, I could go on and on about how amazing my life is from this program. Did I say my sobriety date? It was September 28, 2005. So, I'm not any old timer or anything here. This is all very fresh, and all of these promises, I think, have come to me very, very quickly, and I realize that, and I do not take that for granted, one second. So, and thank you guys so much. Thanks for letting me share.
Tinsley, I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Peter. Really great story.
Love you, man.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Promises are real. And I always long for something that set me free. And I do love to Take me where the promises are.